Builder at Wix.com.
Support for WPR comes from our sustaining members. When you set up an ongoing monthly gift, your generosity benefits everyone who listens to WPR. If you're not currently a sustainer, become one today. Go to WPR.org and click donate.
Support also comes from CTM with their signature production, A Christmas Carol, December 13th through the 23rd, a Madison family tradition at Overture Center's Capitol Theater. Details and tickets at ctmtheater.org.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of November. The press learned earlier this month about last year's discovery of 1,400 artworks worth about $1.4 billion that were hidden in an apartment in Munich. These were pieces by Picasso, Renoir, and Matisse, and we really don't even know the extent of all of these works of art. They were hidden by 80-year-old Cornelius Gurlitt, whose father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, helped Adolf Hitler sell confiscated art. The younger Gurlitt was initially suspected of tax evasion, and that's how they found all of these works, evidently. He says he has no intention of parting with the works and would not voluntarily give anything back. Who owns this artwork, and from whom was it looted? What statute of limitations may apply? What's the history of recovery and return of Nazi stolen art? And will the world have a chance to see any of these hidden masterpieces? We have two guests with us. It should be a really interesting hour. Our first guest is Stuart Eisenstadt. He has worked on and has a deep interest in providing belated justice for victims of the Holocaust and other victims of Nazi tyranny as the result of his leadership of the Clinton administration as special representative of the president and secretary of state on Holocaust-era issues. He has negotiated major agreements with the Swiss, Germans, Austrian, French, and other European countries covering restitution of property, payment for slave and forced laborers, recovery of looted art, bank accounts, and payment of insurance policies, and has written about these events in Imperfect Justice, Looted Assets, Slave Labor, and the Unfinished Business of World War II. He now heads the international practice for the law firm Covington & Burling in Washington. He spent many years in public service in three administrations, Chief White House Domestic Policy Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade, and what we talked about for the Clinton administration. Later in the hour, the founder and co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests this hour. What did you think when you saw this story? And there are so many levels to this story. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
When I saw this report on the news a couple of weeks ago, my mouth was just aghast. I went, oh, my goodness. I would imagine that you may have seen this and thought, oh, yeah, I thought this might be the case. Did this come as a surprise to you?
Yes. We did not know that one individual would have had so many masterpieces. It turns out that Cornelius' father was one-quarter Jewish and was about to be deported to concentration camps when Goebbels learned that he was an art expert and in essence seconded him to work to sell this so-called degenerate art, which is early 20th century German art that had been prevalent in German museums and German Jewish art dealers. And he sold substantial amounts of it, it appears, and gave the money to the Reich, which was the purpose. But it also appears that some of the pieces that were entrusted to him, he did not sell. He kept. And his grandson then, after he died, kept them in a dusty room with orange juice cans and rubbish, no temperature control. And when the police actually located it, they noticed that there were a number of picture frames that were empty indicating that he had sold some of them over the years to have enough money to make do. Now, he didn't put them all on the market at once because that would have, in a sense, blown his cover. And the way it was found is itself quite amazing. He was coming from a train from Zurich back to Munich, where he lives, and he had to pass a border control. And they asked him if he had anything to declare, and he said, well, he had about 9,500 euros in cash. And they asked him if he could see the euros, and they were freshly made euros in large denominations. And they said, well, where did you get this? And he said, oh, I sold a piece of art. And that's what led them to find this stash. Now, amazingly also, after having done that, which is exemplary, they did not publish the list of the art pieces. They did bring a art expert, Mikey Hoffman, in over the last year or so to examine the pieces. It's thought to be worth $1.35 billion.
Goodness.
But they never published the list. And under the Washington principles that I negotiated when I was Under Secretary of State for Economic Affairs in the Clinton administration with 40 countries, including Germany, the whole purpose is when you have looted art, whether it's in a public museum or a private collection, you're supposed to immediately publish the art so that real owners can make claims to them. This wasn't done. It hasn't been done even since its discovery.
Mm-hmm. Do we know where all this art is right now? The authorities took it where?
They took it to a warehouse outside of Munich so that they could examine it in a thorough way and have this Mikey Hoffman look at it and examine it.
I see.
And that's where it is now. It's not in the possession of Mr. Gerlant.
Mm-hmm. You understand this issue very well. Give us a sense of the history of the amount of looted art, the raids on museums and the raids on Jewish families in Germany during World War II by the Nazis.
It's really staggering. It defies imagination. It's believed that up to 600,000 pieces of art
were
confiscated and that perhaps 100,000 are still not discovered. So we're talking about a staggering amount, and that doesn't mean that they're all masterpieces. Hitler had the best of the masterpieces set aside for a museum he was going to build in his hometown of Linz, Austria. But we do know that there were thousands of those that he had set aside for that museum, and that, again, the best estimate is that 600,000 in all were confiscated.
And they were confiscated from museums, from families?
Almost all were confiscated from Jewish owners. Now, in this case, the Gerlant case, it appears that some of the degenerate art, as Hitler called it, modern 20th century art, was taken by the Nazis not only from Jews but from their own state museums.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hitler had banned it as being contrary to the values of the Third Reich.
Oh.
And so he had his officials strip their own museums of this art and sell it. So one of the allies we have, in a sense, in encouraging compliance with the Washington principles, which is both to publish the art and to establish a clear claims resolution process, is that the German state museums want the same thing.
Uh-huh. So, as it stands right now, who do you petition to get somebody to publish a list of all of the paintings that have been confiscated? Is this a legal situation right now?
Well, the Washington principles, which I negotiated in 1998, were specifically said to be non-binding principles that were done within the context of a country's own laws. That's the only way we can get countries to ascribed to them, and over 40 did, and have followed them quite faithfully. But it's not legally binding. There's no mandate. There's no enforcement action if you don't do it. It's held in opprobrium for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. There are also, if you follow the German press, and the American press really covers this story quite differently, but Der Spiegel had a long piece over the weekend, a fascinating interview with this young girl, like Cornelius Gerlant, who sounds like a guy who's just lived by himself with these paintings, and it's a bizarre story, and he's not very healthy, and he doesn't want anybody to have, but that's all he had. He has no TV. He looks at the paintings every day. No family left. His story is pretty bizarre. But also were the reports that whether or not there's a statute of limitations here. Was there anything like that in what you negotiated, that after a certain number of years, indeed, he may own these and there's nothing anybody can do?
The thrust of the Washington Principles is to try to resolve these disputes on the basis of the merits of ownership, not technical defenses like the statute of limitations. Mm. It's sometimes called lashes or jurisdictional issues. Now, frankly, a number of American museums have become quite aggressive in pursuing those technical defenses themselves. But the whole thrust of the Washington Principles is that when there's Nazi-looted art, the statute of limitations shouldn't apply. And in the event, you know, there's normally a principle in interpreting the statute of limitations, which is that the statute shouldn't run until the claimant has reason to know that a claim exists. Well, that reason to know doesn't exist to this day until the artwork is published. Then there's a reason to know. But, I mean, otherwise, you wouldn't know where to file a claim.
Mm-hmm. And tell me again why the artwork has not been published. Under what justification?
The Gerlitz says it's his property. It's his personal property, and he wants to keep it himself. And he's a private. He says, I have a privacy right. And the prosecutor in Bavaria, Germany has a federal system like we do with states and the federal government. States have substantial authority. So the state government of Bavaria is basically taking a position, which we think is totally incorrect, that privacy and a tax evasion case that is pursuing against Gerlitz should supersede returning the artwork. You can have a tax evasion case and still publish the artwork.
Right. Right. And also there's this, it's hard not to take into consideration here the fact that you have probably some absolutely great works of art that, you know, if not to return to the people who own those works of art, which it should be, you just want to have a big public exhibition so we can all see these works of art, right?
Yes, and that's a very good point, actually. It's not just that you want to facilitate particular claims. And by the way, these should be out-of-court claims done by an administrative tribunal, which is what the Washington Principles call for. It is that the art world and those interested in art should themselves know what's in this. This is a treasure trove.
Yes.
There may be many artworks by famous artists, and you mentioned a number of them, Matisse and Picasso and others, who did works of art that aren't known except through this collection. Or if they were known, they've passed out of memory for now 60 or 70 years. So there's a general desire and need for the world as a whole to have a sense of what the components of this artwork are.
Right. Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our first guest on this Munich Art Find and the many questions that surround this, the history of confiscation by the Nazis of art from Jewish families and perhaps from museums as well during World War II. And this particular find, which is just incredible, 1,400 pieces of art, including artworks from these very, very famous painters. And we don't, in some cases, even know what it is because what's in there is not being published and we're not sure what may be missing and we don't know who owns it and whether or not it's rightfully owned by this one guy who's 80 years old who's lived with these paintings that his father got by doing artwork with Hitler. It's a story. It's a story. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Stuart Eisenstadt, the first hour of the program. He's done a lot of work in this area, particularly when he was special representative of President Clinton on Holocaust-era issues. So he's negotiated agreements with a number of countries covering restitution of property, payment for slave and forced laborers, etc. And he has worked in under three U.S. presidents and was ambassador to the European Union for a number of years. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Marcus in Green Bay is our first caller, Ambassador. Hi, Marcus.
Oh, hi. Alrighty. I now know why callers say that they find this subject fascinating. I listen to public radio all the time, and boy, this one. So I want to make sure I understand something. I didn't hear about this until I was driving home and I tuned it in. So I didn't have time to look up the article or anything. So the German government found this, and now they're doing what so many people all through history, they're actually hoarding it and not allowing anyone to look at it and appraise it or see, you know, follow. I mean, and they're not giving access. And is that right? And the reason I ask is because, like I said, you know, all through history, the Egyptians, you know, looting that stuff. And, you know, this, you can melt it down or for gold or cash. And then you have other people that just, it sits in their bedroom above their bed, and nobody gets to see this precious history and all that. So
right. So what's the truth here? What have the Germans done? We've covered a little bit of this, Ambassador.
Yes. I mean, Germany has an exemplary record after the war of dealing with their Nazi past. They've paid $60 billion in compensation to victims and continue to do so. I negotiate separately with the Jewish Claims Conference for home care. They have Holocaust education and Holocaust museums and so forth. For 50 years, they did not open up their central Nazi archives at Bad Arolsen, the central repository of the Nazi records, on the grounds of privacy. And we said, whose privacy are you really protecting? The families want to know about what happened to their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's open, and this is a similar issue being made now, which is what your caller is saying. By not publishing the list, you're not giving people an opportunity to know whether or not it may be theirs. Doesn't mean it is. Doesn't mean it's definite. But at least there has to be some way in which to let claimants and the world know what's here. This is an extraordinary finding. And the notion that one person who got it under suspicious circumstances, or whose father did, could keep this art from being published so that we know exactly what is there, when did it come into his possession, how did his father get it, what did he pay for it, is inconceivable.
Right, right. What rules apply? Because it's my understanding that the son is 80, he'll soon be 81 years old. He has a serious heart condition, not in the best of health. He may not live all that much longer. Then what happens?
Well, that's a good question also, because it's not clear that Mr. Gerlitt has any heirs. So normally when someone passes away and has property and they have no heirs, it reverts to the state, or in this case to Bavaria, and it would become the owner of the artwork by virtue of there being no will and no estate unless he subsequently decides to have one. So in that case, the Munich government, the Bavarian government, Munich, would have to make a decision about what to do. And they have the art now in their possession in a warehouse in any event. It's not in Gerlitt's possession right now.
Mm-hmm.
They took it all out so it could be analyzed and reviewed by an expert.
But they did that a year ago.
They did that a year ago, and that's time enough.
I would think so.
That's time enough.
Yeah.
Now it's necessary to publish it. And there are more than enough people who could help them with the provenance of their art. It's one of the great finds of the century.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the key is getting it published. Everything else will follow.
Thank you, Marcus, for the call. We have a comment on Facebook. Ambassador Eisenstadt, the art should be sold at auction, with proceeds being divided among any remaining World War II Nazi victims, particularly death camp survivors.
Well, yes, I mean, that's one possibility. But one has to realize there are 500,000 Holocaust survivors in this country, around a half of whom are poor. So dispersing that in equal shares to all would give each a very, very small amount. perhaps it could go into home care or particular programs for the needy, but just spreading it on a per capita basis might give individual claimants a fairly small amount. And again, we don't know how many of these were actually looted from Jewish owners and how much from German state museums. And that's why, again, it's so important to publish it so we know where they came from and what the provenance of that art is. When we negotiated the Washington Principles on Nazi looted art in 1998 at the State Department, sitting next to me was Philippe de Montebello, who was then the really elegant chairman of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. He said the art world will never be the same as a result of these principles. And what he meant is that if you and I or your callers go to buy a house, the first thing you do is you get a lawyer or title searcher to make sure that there's good title to the property, going back to the first owner, and no gaps. But in the art world, believe it or not, with much more expensive pieces, that's not the rule. You just rely on the good faith of your seller, your immediate seller. You didn't ask where he got it from. And what the Washington Principles implore people to do is to go back, and big auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's have full-time art historians, Monica Dugot at Christie's, Julian Simmons at Sotheby's, and Monica's told me that they may have returned as many as a half a dozen paintings a year sent to them for consignment because they think the provenance is very uncertain.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's go to Chuck in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. My comment is just how bizarre it is that the Nazis were against what they call degenerate art, and yet were completely blind to their own degenerate behavior.
Well, that's a beautiful way of putting it. The notion that modern art was degenerate and that their mass genocide was somehow in accordance with German principles is, as you put it beautifully, really a perverse notion. I couldn't say it any better than you did.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck, so much for your call. Don in Prairie du Chien. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious. The Nazis were well known for their record keeping. Are there any records of this art that have not come to light yet? And if so, potentially, why not?
That's a really good question, because it's inconceivable to me that they would have handed over to Gerlitt the responsibility for, in effect, fencing or selling all of this degenerate art they were confiscating and giving the money back without keeping meticulous records of exactly what he had, what he was given, what he disposed of, what he got for it. And how one could, under the eyes and nose of the Nazis, have been able to secrete 1,400 of those very paintings he was supposed to presumably have sold on their behalf is a mystery within a mystery. For the very reasons you say, they were very meticulous. One has to assume that they had a very complete inventory at some point of the looted art that they took. And it would be interesting to compare that with what he's been able to, and through his son, been able to maintain all these many years.
Isn't there anybody like you, for instance, Ambassador Eisenstadt, who might be able to, I don't know if the son has a phone or not, but knock on his door or catch him when he's going to the grocery store and say, I'd really like to have a conversation with you, and then for some period of time describe how it's in the interest of the world in understanding beauty and understanding the history of what happened here and understanding the Holocaust and in so many different ways. There's so much that we could be enhanced intellectually and spiritually and emotionally by knowing this whole story and seeing these paintings. Couldn't somebody persuade him that he should do something differently, that he should...
First of all, you should know that the U.S. government and the State Department, and I'm special advisor to Secretary Kerry, Douglas Davidson at the State Department, is a permanent government employee there, and he heads the office. And we've worked with our embassy in Berlin to present a demarche to the German government a week ago Friday, and that these artworks be published, and that a dispute resolution process be established. So the U.S. government has a very real interest. These Washington principles were very much our idea, but we negotiated them very carefully with all the key member states, including Germany. So, yes, it would have an enormous educational aspect to it. because it would concretize. You know, when you talk about 600,000 pieces of art taken, it's such a fantastic figure. It's hard to get your eyes and ears
yes.
and hands around it.
Right.
But here, when you see 1,400 actual paintings, it gives a concreteness to the brutality. That is, that the Holocaust was not only the most brutal genocide of people, it was the most thoroughgoing confiscation of the property.
Mm-hmm.
Art, real estate, homes, jewelry, businesses, all were confiscated without compensation or with minimal compensation. Now, ironically, Gurlitt, after the war, was treated by the Allied troops in the U.S. as a victim of the Nazis, not as a perpetrator.
Right.
Reason being, he convinced them that by selling some of the Jewish art, the art by Jewish owners, he facilitated their escape. And that may well be the case, but, you know, that art was often done at ridiculously low prices because people feared for their lives. They wanted to get anything out. But he was considered a victim and was rehabilitated.
And he really was what, in it for himself?
Yes, he was in it for he was playing a double game.
Right.
He was, on the one hand, saving his own neck by helping Goebbels and the Nazis sell the art. And second, it appears, he was in it for his own sake, taking some of it for his own personal use or enjoyment.
Mm. I know you're not feeling very well, and we'll let you go. I just wanted you to tell me what's happening now. What will happen now?
Well, I think that we've put a lot of influence and pressure on Germany to have these published, and they have set up a joint task force of the Bavarian government and the federal government to look into this. They also have a commission on art recovery themselves. We're telling them to activate that. So we're doing everything we can because we know that some of the art absolutely belongs to American citizens. For example, Elaine Rosenberg in New York, whose father-in-law, Paul Rosenberg, was one of the most famous collectors of modern art, has already lodged a claim, just based on the photos in the New York Times, of one of the Matisses, which is quite clearly hers. So, you know, this is an American story as well, and we want to make sure that Americans get their artworks back.
Thank you so much for being with us. I heard you on the BBC 8 weeks ago, and I just said, oh, we've got to get him on the air. This is just an amazing story. And I thank you so much for your work and for being with us. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our guest, the first half hour, we're on the same subject. We have a terrific guest coming up, so don't go away, anybody. Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, former U.S. ambassador to the European Union, working with Secretary of State John Kerry, special advisor on Holocaust issues, and has done, as I said, a lot of work negotiating really major agreements with the Swiss and the Germans, Austrians, French, and other European countries, covering restitution of all that was taken from Jews during the Nazi reign of terror. Our phone number remains 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The founder and co-chair of the Commission for looted art in Europe will be joining us by phone from London as we continue our program. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
Let me tell you one little thing about penguins that you may not know. You better wear glove guards from your hand all the way to your elbow and above, because as cute as those little animals look like, they will beat the you-know-what out of you.
People are reading, and if they're reading on e-books, that's great. If they're reading in the hard copy, that's great. They're reading.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you to the corporate sponsors who help support WPR programs, including Qual Line Fence Corporation, Buttonwood Partners Incorporated, and the Madison Symphony Orchestra. Become a corporate sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Laura Beck Nielsen, dedicated to simple and dignified cremation plans to protect Wisconsin families. The Neptune Society, America's most trusted cremation services. More from Laura at 608-658-7717.
Central Time this afternoon, looking at the negotiations in Geneva over Iran's nuclear program, Central Time 3 to 6. Ann Weber is our guest now, and Ann is the founder and co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. It's an international nonprofit representative body which researches, identifies, and recovers cultural property on behalf of families, institutions, and governments all over the world. We are this hour, in case you're just tuning us in, talking about that huge art finding, 1,400 works of great art. We don't even know all that it is, that was found in Munich, and it was in the apartment of the son of an art dealer for Adolf Hitler. So we're looking at where it is, who needs to be notified, and who will publish the works of art that are there, and why it's taking so long to do that, and how huge a find this is. And Anne, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I know you've done a lot of work in this area. I can't imagine there are other finds that are as large as this. Have there been 1,400 works of great art by really the masters?
Yes, it's a huge find. It's a huge find today, really, because we know that at the end of the war, a lot of these Nazi art dealers kept large collections for themselves. It may be that Hildebrand Gurlitt, who was the art dealer that had this, he died in a car crash in 1956. And it may be that there wasn't a chance to dispose of it over the years, which is what the other dealers did.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, it went to his wife, and then his wife left almost everything to the son. And he has guarded it, as we've heard in the first part of this program, selling works only when he needed to raise some money. So it is a staggering find, and very much reflects how people were able to keep this looted artwork. Stuart Eisenstadt was talking about how many works are still missing, and there are thousands and thousands of works still missing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an indication of that.
How much did we know about Hildebrand Gurlitt, and how much have we known since his death and during his time as an art dealer who worked with the Nazis? Do we know his history?
Well, it's a very good question that you ask. Quite a lot was known about Hildebrand Gurlitt. He was a very well-known dealer. You know, the art world was quite small in Germany, as it is in most places. You know, people tend to know each other because they trade with each other, and they know who the experts are. And Hildebrand Gurlitt was very well-known in Germany, and because he was selling all these art works for Goebbels, they were being sold outside the country because the Nazis wanted foreign currency. So he was well known outside as well as inside Germany. And in the 1940s, between 1942 and 45, he was in France buying art specifically for Hitler. And after the war, he was well known in that art world. And we know that for example, that there were works of art that he was lending, looted works of art, that he was lending to museums in Germany for exhibition in the 1950s, all of which were looted.
Huh.
And everybody, you know, it wasn't so much a secret who he was and where his collection came from.
Hmm. Because it's interesting to read particularly the German news reports, which I've done some of over the past few days, which indicate that, well, we're not really sure, you know, if he was trying to save degenerate art or if indeed he really wasn't a Nazi sympathizer. They were trying to make his background a little murkier than what you've just laid out.
His background was pretty clear. I mean, at the end of the war, people all told lots of stories to save themselves.
Mm-hmm.
When they were being interrogated by the Americans or the British. And if you read his interrogations actually are on our website at lootedart.com. And, and he talks quite interestingly about how, of course, he was never selling anything that he shouldn't have done or not buying anything that he shouldn't have done, and that he was always an anti-Nazi, and that he's asked specifically about where some of these works of art are from, because they found that the Americans found, the Third Army found some 136 works of art in his possession at the end of the war. And when they asked him where all these came from, he gave differing answers. On a Chagall, for example, he said that it had belonged to his sister. And on the Picasso, he said that he had bought it from the artist. But when it came, just 5 years later, and he was trying to get all this art back, he gave a completely different version of where these came from.
I see.
And got a Swiss friend to say that he had given both these paintings to Gurlitt. So there was a lot of, you know, dissembling
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that all these works are in this warehouse, and it has been a year now, and the Germans have not published what's in this collection, which everybody in the art world and people who love art are very interested in finding out?
It's actually very shocking.
Yes.
In fact, it's longer than that. It's 20 months. When this story
wow.
broke, you know, our view was, and it remains, that the story is as much a story of why the Germans concealed this as the finding of it, because it reflects how difficult it has been over the years to recover looted art in Germany, and how it's still so much of a problem. Only 4 years ago, the German Minister of Culture said that there were thousands and thousands, and I quote him, thousands and thousands of looted works of art in German museums which have not been disclosed. And we know that we negotiate policy as well with the German government, as well as with other governments. And we know that there are Washington principles which have not been implemented in Germany to a great extent, the ones that Stuart Eisenstadt so brilliantly put together, and that there is a general reluctance to deal with this issue.
Why?
It's a good question. You know, museums are often there, you know, museums feel that their mission is to keep works of art together rather than to disperse them, even if they don't actually belong to the museum. So that may be one imperative. It may also be that museums were very active in the seizure of works of art during the Nazi era.
I see.
German museums. And the museum directors and the curators were quite active in that. So it also may be that there's a degree of institutional shame about the institution and not wanting some of that history to emerge.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing and what can be done to at least get a list, to say nothing of the fact that the rightful owners should be found, of these 1,400 works of art? How do you get that list to be published?
Well, absolutely. We've been talking to German authorities ever since this story broke, of course, and saying that they must publish a full list of all the works of art, and they must publish it with all the information that they have. We understand that there were records found in the apartment which explain where some of the works come from, and these have not been disclosed at all yet. Only 25 works of the 1,400 have been published so far. The Germans said that they would start publishing some 590 works they believe to come from Jewish families on Monday, but not one has yet been published.
Hmm.
They said yesterday that they were going to start returning some of the works to Cornelius Gurlitt, and that would be unconscionable to do that without listing what they are and explaining why they think they can return them to him. So it's still very much an issue. We did achieve one result, though, yesterday, which was that we had said to the German authorities that they started the 25 works they published last week were all published only in German.
Mm.
And we said to them, you know, that because of what happened, you know, in the Nazi era, most of the families to whom this information is critical don't speak German anymore. They don't read German.
Yes.
And the families may not even have come from Germany, and it's absolutely essential that it be published in English. And so finally yesterday we were told that they were going to do it, and it was that those 25 paintings are now published in English, thankfully. But there is a long way to go, and there's a general, you know, it's very hard to understand why these works have not yet been published.
And from the other work that you've done in this area, what would be a logical conclusion from all of this? Would it ultimately, although it may take a long, long time, would ultimately the list be published and families from whom the work had been looted and maybe even museums would present the proper documentation? This belonged to my grandfather, or this belonged to its inner family. Or, as German papers have suggested, could it rightfully be still in the in the hands of, and legally, of Cornelius Gurlitt? And is there any chance that it could just, you know, be put in a brand new museum?
Well, there are a lot of very important questions there. If I could just let me pick up about the museum,
because mm-hmm.
some of these works of art, as we've heard earlier, were taken from museums in Germany. But under German law, post-war law, none of the museums are entitled to recover those paintings because they were taken, given up by the museums voluntarily as part of that Nazi regime, that governed Germany, and so they're not entitled to have them back.
I see.
And so there is it's a good question about what should happen to them and whether those could go on into a public exhibition somewhere, a public display. And certainly as far as the works that belong to the individual families are concerned, we are most keen that the German government, both the regional, the federal government and the central government, establish a proper claims process. It would be the thought that any of these works could go back to Mr. Gurlitt, and that it would not be possible under German law as it currently stands for anybody to recover them,
yes,
is obviously unacceptable today. Just because he's been able to hold on to them without anybody finding out till now, or without those people to whom it matters finding out.
Right.
Because there is certainly, I mean, certainly people in Germany and Austria have been saying that they always knew that he had this art collection. Some of the art people in the art world have been saying that. But it's obviously very important that the families are able to claim and to recover. And Stu Eisenstadt just before was talking about an alternative dispute resolution, and that would be the way to do it. An independent claims process needs to be set up.
Mm-hmm.
So these works could be recovered.
What a story this is, isn't it? I mean, this is such a large story.
It's a huge story with so many repercussions.
Right.
We have been talking to the German government for quite a long time now about all the other issues in Germany. In a sense, this story encapsulates all the problems that there are in Germany, the reluctance to undertake research, the reluctance to publish what there is in the museum that is looted, the reluctance to disclose it to the families, disclose the information they have to the families, the reluctance to return. And we hope very much that Germany will see this as an opportunity to redress all that what has happened so far. Certainly the federal authorities, the German culture minister, has been very proactive in this field. And we very much hope that the opportunity will be taken, because Germany could actually seize the opportunity and turn into a leader in this, rather than, you know, finding itself foundering in the situation that it is in now.
We'll take phone calls for Anne, and we'll do that in a moment. Our guest this half hour is Anne Weber. She is founder and co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. And we're welcoming calls for her, 800-486-8655. We're talking about what was a huge story and remains a huge story, the discovery by the press, even though the confiscation of the paintings took place 20 months ago now. 1,400 artworks in an apartment in Munich being kept by an 80-year-old man who pretty much, as far as I can tell, wasn't talking to anybody, didn't watch the news, just lived with these paintings, and that was his life, these masterpieces. And his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, had helped Adolf Hitler sell confiscated art. So we're looking at all the levels of this and welcoming your calls. 800-486-8655. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from proud sustaining members who make ongoing contributions. Become a sustainer today, and your gift will help the more than 200,000 people who listen every day. Go to WPR.org and click donate.
Support also comes from Hilldale Shopping Center, celebrating 50 years, offering upscale shopping and dining with over 60 national and locally owned stores, restaurants, and Sundance cinemas on Madison's Near West Side. More at Hilldale.com.
Hour two of our program tomorrow, the enthusiastic and knowledgeable Jeff Greenfield on his book, If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History. He will be with us on the day before the 50th anniversary of the assassination. Let's go to Mary in Westfield. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Does anyone know who purchased the piece of art that prompted the arrest of Mr. Gerlach?
Who purchased the art in, I guess it was Switzerland, Anne?
I didn't catch the question. Sorry.
She wondered if anybody knows who purchased the work of art that resulted in authorities, I believe it's in Switzerland, who found him on a train and wondered why he had so much money. He said he...
Oh, yes. No, well, it's not clear that he was selling a work of art in Switzerland.
Oh, really?
Indeed, the art gallery who he claimed he had been to said that they hadn't seen him since 1996.
Oh!
There's a lot in this story that has still not been...
Yeah.
It is not clear. The same art gallery said that they'd been sending catalogs of their sales to him, which would be to his apartment in Munich, which had been returned unknown at this address, which is hard to understand either because he's been living in the same apartment for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth of what he was doing, you know, in Switzerland and went on his way, you know, on that trip to Switzerland is really unclear at the moment.
Mm. And the many truths in this story, many of which would be pretty hard to take, I would think, if you know the whole story here. It's quite a story.
I think it's a terrible story.
Yes, it is.
Because when you think of all these people, mean, you know, who were so desperate to survive, not to be murdered, and, you know, to sell, if they did sell it, to Gerlach, it was because they were desperate to have some money to, which then went back to the German Reich so they could pay their flight tax out.
Right.
And some of those people wouldn't have been able to get out because it was very late. Gerlach was buying 1939, 1940 from people trying to flee, and some of those people may not have got out. So it's a terrible story, and because it is so bound up with persecution and murder, that's why it is so hard to understand that this has been kept secret all this time.
Mm-hmm.
It is a terrible, terrible, tragic tale.
Yeah. Maddie in Wapaka.
Hello?
Yes, Maddie, go ahead. Go
Hello,
ahead.
I can't hear you.
We can hear you, Maddie. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to comment that I think the American people shouldn't feel like their morals are so much more wonderful than the German people. Look what happened to the American Indian people. And continues to happen. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. A caller who couldn't hang on asked, how do you establish a protocol, and is there one in place already, for ownership of confiscated, looted artwork? Anne?
There's in Germany or in general, do you want to focus on Germany?
Please.
Yes, well, in Germany, it's a very random situation today. We represent quite a number of American families as well, and you find that, you know, your chance, you know, you might find a looted painting, you might track it down to a particular museum, particular collection, and it's the museum itself that will make the decision whether or not the family gets it back, which is not really a normal principle of justice. Normally, the person in possession of stolen property doesn't decide whether the rightful owner should get it back or not. So there is no real principle of return in Germany. The law is not very helpful because the law, as you mentioned earlier, there is a statute of limitations. So after 30 years, title does go to whoever has, you know, whoever has it, if it's in a private collection. So it's really on moral grounds that you have to try and recover these works of art. And that's true throughout Europe, pretty much. There is no... Austria has a law that enables the return of looted art, and the Czech Republic has a law, but there's virtually no other... There are no other countries that have laws to enable the return. So it's really through moral persuasion that works of art can be returned. And if you have this situation where there is inconsistency in Germany... You may go to one museum in the state, and they will return. They will agree to return, and you can go to another museum in the same state, where they have, and you're making a claim for a work from the same collection taken at the same time in the same circumstances, and they can turn the claim down.
Huh.
So what you need is a really consistent and impartial system for claims resolution, where there are clear, you know, there are clear terms of reference which explain on what grounds a work will be returned, what framework, of, you know, who will be deciding, on what grounds they'll be deciding. At the moment, that doesn't exist there.
Yeah. I meant to ask Ambassador Eisenstadt about this the first half hour. When I heard him on the BBC a few weeks ago, he was talking about the amount of looted art that may be in Russia. Is there a lot of looted art there? Have you dealt with Russia?
We have. There are thousands and thousands of looted artworks in Russia. Because what happened was when they went back to the Soviet Union in 1945, they took a lot of works of art that they found in Berlin and in all parts of East Germany as reparations. And those have never been returned, and they in fact have nationalized them and say they're not going to return. They did pass a law in the late 1990s saying that those works of art that belong to victims of the Holocaust would be returned to them, but we put in one of the first claims actually in 1999, and we know that nobody has got any works of art back. It isn't they will not abide by their own law.
Really?
And if you go to the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, or if you go to the Pushkin Museum in Moscow, you will see works of art that were looted from families on their walls.
Really?
So it's quite that's quite shocking.
Yes, I would imagine. Well, the other thing is that you think of all the people in the art world and art lovers, and they're all over the world, who are just so anxious to know, putting aside all the other deep levels of conversation with this whole discovery, just what's in it in terms of art, that there may be works here that art scholars are just so anxious to see and to know about.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, we don't... at that level alone, these works of art should be published so that people are able to study them and to know what there is. We've been told Michael Hoffman, the person who's been doing the research, single-handedly, that's also pretty remarkable. It doesn't suggest there was any kind of sense of urgency from the German authorities to have any one person researching 1,400 works of art. It's a huge burden upon her. But we hear from her that some of these works of art have not been published before. So very important for the world to know what these... Because these were great artists. These were artists who at the time, you know, were just beginning to make their way in the world, you know, were beginning to be well-known. And so to see the work, what they created, we all very much want to see that. You know, it's important. So it's important they be published on so many different levels.
Well, and they will if your work pays off. I can tell you're working.
We're very persistent.
I can tell you're working tirelessly on this. And thank you so much for being with us. You're most informative. Thanks.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Anne Weber, our guest this part of the program, she is founder of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe and founded the Central Registry of Looted Cultural Property 1933 to 1945. If you go to, that would be an interesting website to go to, lootedart.com, you'll find much more information about all that we've been talking about. And thanks to our guest, Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, for being with us the first half hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this very interesting program. And thanks to Robin Cherry for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you tomorrow from 1 until 3, and I hope you will stay with us. Jeff Greenfield, our guest tomorrow this hour, whose latest book is If Kennedy Lived. This is the Ideas Network.
The Theatre of Ballet Arts Incorporated is pleased to bring their production of Thumbelina to southwestern Wisconsin for evening and matinee performances at the Mineral Point Opera House, November 23rd and 24th, and Platteville Municipal Auditorium, December 7th and 8th. Wisconsin Public Radio is proud to support live dance performance. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
When you shop with our online partners, like the NPR Shop or Amazon.com, a portion of your purchase may benefit Wisconsin Public Radio. Learn more at WPR.org/shop.
Mm-hmm. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On today's show, we get the latest on negotiations to curb Iran's nuclear program and the balance between concessions and sanction lifting.
Also, as the nation remembers JFK this week, our guest says he was far from the liberal icon he was made out to be. He says it makes sense to claim him for the conservative party.
The United States Postal Service recently announced another year of billion-dollar losses as its customers turn to electronic communication, but our guest makes the case to return to the joys of putting pen to paper.
As debate here in Wisconsin continues, we'll hear about the rise of natural gas fracking and the people behind it.
And for backyard birders and beyond, we'll get expert advice on some of your most burning birdwatching questions.
Wisconsin has been collecting pictures of license plates, but some lawmakers are calling for a moratorium on how long the state can keep them.
It's Central Time, coming up after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Secretary of State John Kerry is confirming an important milestone in U.S.-Afghan relations.
We reached an agreement as to the final language of the bilateral security agreement that will be placed before the Loya Jirga tomorrow.
Kerry says the agreement calls for American troops to play a limited role. Most of them are due to be out of Afghanistan by the end of next year. Those remaining will help to train and equip Afghan forces as they become the primary enforcers of security in Afghanistan. In addition, Kerry denies that Afghan President Hamid Karzai demanded a letter of apology from the Obama administration for civilian casualties during the Afghan war. Ceremonies, documentaries, as well as television specials are honoring the legacy of the late President John F. Kennedy and will continue to do so through this Friday, which marks 50 years since the day the revered